This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Nabil Biagio, and here's what's coming up.
There was another major decision taken by the president. He has actually fired all the police chiefs. Local police chiefs have been fired.
That's VOA's Frederick Kundikije from the Central African Service on the political shakeup in Burundi. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Burundi has a new prime minister today. President Evariste Ndayishimiye fired former Prime Minister Alain Guillaume Bunyoni amid claims of a possible coup being planned against him by unnamed plotters. VOA's Frederick Kundikeja has been following the developments in Burundi and tells me the situation remains fluid with more changes expected to follow, including a possible complete reshuffle of government.
The news that we got this morning is that we have a new, Burundi has a new prime minister, Mr. Gervais Ndirakobucha, who has been until today the security and interior minister. A few days after the president lamented a lot about some big fish out there who were bent on toppling his government. So as we talk, the new prime minister is in parliament where he has to take oath of office. The ceremonies are still ongoing.
It's curious that the president would appoint his security minister as the new prime minister. But let's back it up a little bit. President Evariste Ndayishimiye fell out with his former prime minister, Alain Guillaume Bunyoni, and there were claims of a possible coup being afoot. Tell me about the build-up to the firing of Prime Minister Bunyoni.
As I said earlier, this is happening after months and months, you know, President Ndayishimiye lamenting about those close collaborators who were trying to sabotage all his plans, being, you know, the shortage of gas and so many other plans. And although he never named Bunyoni, Guillaume Bunyoni, his prime minister, as the culprit, so many people in Burundi and all those who follow politics in Burundi knew he was actually referring or alluding to his prime minister, who was considered like a rival.
And things have been calm in Burundi for several years, probably since 2015, and even reforms and steps to fight corruption and impunity were put in place. Relations with the West have been improving. What do these recent developments mean for the stability of the country?
There are some reports that all those good initiatives taken by the president were somehow thwarted by people from inside the government. And obviously, as the case now is at the open, people were talking about some people, you know, high-ranked members of government were not really adhering to his political agenda. As we also talk, I would mention that, you know, there was another major decision taken by the president. He has actually fired all the police chiefs, local police chiefs have been fired. So we waiting for a new government, a reshuffle of the government, and also new members of the, you know, until to the local, you know, local officials, including those police chiefs.
Has there been any regional or international reaction to what is happening in Burundi?
Not that I know. We trying to get reactions from political pundits and political analysts from around the world, especially Burundians, those who are close to the government and those who are in opposition. We trying to gather all those reactions. We're going to be able to see clearly in the days ahead.
That was Frederick Kundikije speaking with me this past hour. Anti-migrant groups in South Africa are outraged at a government decision to extend the residence and work permits of almost 200,000 Zimbabweans until the end of June next year. Pretoria had initially said the Zimbabwean Exemption Permits, or ZEPs, would expire in December this year. The government had insisted socio-economic conditions in Zimbabwe had improved since it granted the permits more than a decade ago, so it was time for ZEP holders to return home. Darren Taylor reports.
Opposition party the Patriotic Alliance and Operation Dudula, formed with the stated aim of pushing illegal foreigners out of South Africa, are two of the organizations that say the government's decision is unconstitutional. Alliance senior official Mario Kumalo says the party will unite with others to take the state to court to force it to overturn the decision to extend the permits.
There's a lot of miscarriage in our country when it comes to oath of office, and a lot of miscarriage against the constitution of the country and the people of this country. There's a lot of government overreach and government overstep. The law has been broken. The Immigration Act is a point of departure. Home Affairs acted beyond its scope and beyond their powers.
Chairperson of the Zimbabwean Immigration Federation, Luke Dzviti, says he's not jumping for joy at the extension of the ZEPs either.
We are not really relieved by this extension, but a lot of Zimbabweans have really shown excitement in the extension by 6 months because it means they'll get a salary for an extra 6 months. But we do not know what the minister's advisors told the minister, because the problems that we have now in renewing the visas is the same problem that we have before 30 June next year, as the conditions still remain the same.
Home Affairs Minister Aaron Motsoaledi says he granted the extension to ZEP holders for humanitarian and practical reasons. Those with the documents can apply to keep them, but immigration lawyers say the process is very expensive and complicated. Dzviti says the hostile conditions attached to such an application make it almost impossible for those with permits to renew them.
For example, one needs to have a Labor Department certificate whereby the requirements for that are that an employee who is a ZEP holder must bring adverts from the newspapers back in 2010 to show that she got a job through newspapers, which no one has. Some got jobs through a notice board or through friends and things like that. We simply got jobs because...
Kumalo says the sooner the Zimbabweans leave South Africa, the better.
There is no war in Zimbabwe. There is no war in SADC. People come into our country claiming to be refugees and asylum seekers. That's a violation of foreign policy. And to our understanding, the South African government has been defrauding the United Nations. Zimbabwe should actually take accountability of its people. They should take off its people. We have our own problems. Since 94, we never had the chance to solve our own problems in South Africa. But we keep allowing an influx. And we need mass deportation for people to go back. We can compromise on that. The Patriotic Alliance is very direct and clear on that.
The South African government believes its conditions for ZEP holders to renew their permits are fair. It says it, and it alone, has the right to extend state documents, and if need be, will argue so in court. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
At least 15 people, including many women and children, have died in a landslide in western Uganda. The Uganda Red Cross posted images of workers shoveling through mud for survivors and says at least 6 people have been rescued. The incident took place in Kasese District in the foothills of Rwenzori Mountains along the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. Reuters notes the area is prone to landslides during the rainy season, which so far this year has caused flooding and the destruction of crops, homes, and infrastructure. Reuters says strong rains are expected through December, and authorities have warned people living in mountain areas to consider evacuating to safer ground. You're listening to African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com and look for VOA programs on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, says around 380 people were killed in tribal clashes in Sudan between January and August. The UN agency said more than 430 people were injured during the same period in 224 violent incidents in 12 of the country's 18 states. West Darfur State was the hardest hit with 76 incidents that killed at least 145 people and wounded 156 others, according to OCHA. The clashes, which are mostly between Arab and non-Arab tribes, have displaced nearly 200,000 people and put a massive strain on aid agencies operating in the troubled northeastern African country. Authorities in Cameroon say Anglophone separatists have attacked a Francophone village that was hosting people displaced by the five-year separatist conflict. Officials in the town of Bangoren says the rebels torch homes and markets and abducted at least five youths. Hundreds of English-speaking displaced fled into the bush for fear they would be blamed by the host community, underscoring tensions with Cameroon's French-speaking majority. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Bangoren, Cameroon.
Scores of people talk among themselves as they shop at the Bangoren Market Square. Bangoren is located in Cameroon's French-speaking West Region, which shares a border with the English-speaking Northwest Region. Local officials say that usually more than 500 merchants and buyers visit the market each day. But attendance has drastically dropped for fear the English-speaking rebels may strike at any time, according to Bangoren residents. Abubakar Hamagadu is coordinator of militia groups created by local officials to prevent separatists from infiltrating the town.
We are here in difficulties because people, they know to sleep, they know to chop.
Hamagadu says civilians in Bangoren are in pain and serious difficulties after a series of hit-and-run rebel attacks in their town within the past 3 days. He says dozens of houses have been torched, money and goods stolen, scores of civilians wounded, and five youths abducted by English-speaking separatists. Hamagabdu says the separatists cross over using the porous border that separates English and French-speaking regions. Hamagabdu has appealed to Cameroon's central government to deploy more troops to protect Bangoren. He also asked the government to compensate people whose houses and goods were torched by the fighters and pleaded with separatists to spare the lives of abducted civilians. Separatists have claimed responsibility over the attack on social media but have not said if they will release the abducted youths. Cameroon government officials say Bangoren hosts at least 800 people who fled fighting between separatist and government troops in the northwest and southwest regions. A majority of the displaced people are schoolgoers in search of education. 18-year-old high school student Agnes Goran fled from the northwest town of Kumbu. Goran says on Monday, rebels chased students out of schools.
We escaped from our towns and villages in the northwest and in the southwest and came here for our education. Fighters will allow us to go to school. Children need an education, is a fundamental human right. These fighters will spare schools from their attack.
The government on Wednesday dispatched a delegation to Bangoren to assure civilians that measures are being taken to safeguard people and their goods. The group of government and military officials was led by West Region Governor Awa Fonka. Fonka says separatists are infiltrating the region from Bui, an administrative unit in the Northwest region. He says troops stationed along the porous border need cooperation from local residents.
We came to make the population know that we continue to take measures to ensure their security. But of course, for this to happen, at all times, we need their participation. We need them to give information to the security services.
Fonka warned host communities against accusing English speakers of hiding separatists who infiltrate Bangoran. He said all displaced English speakers in Bangoran are also escaping from separatist atrocities. Fonka pleaded with English and French-speaking civilians in Bangoran to live in peace and help fight separatists, whom he described as Cameroon's common enemy. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Bangoran, Western Cameroon.
The Committee to Protect Journalists is calling for the release of three detained reporters and assurances they face no further legal harassment. Damascene Mutuimana, Shadrach Niosenga, and Jean-Baptiste Chimia work for the YouTube-based Aiwaku TV. Authorities charged them in October 2018 with spreading false information with the intention of creating a hostile international opinion of Rwanda, publishing unoriginal statements or photos, and inciting insurrection. Their trial began in August 2021 and concluded on July 15. Prosecutors recommended prison sentences of 22 years and 5 months. Sources told the CPJ that a verdict is expected on September 15. The CPJ says the Office of the Public Prosecutor and Justice Ministry have not responded to requests for comment. The Press Freedom Group's latest prison census found that Rwanda has detained 7 members of the press, making it the 3rd worst jailer of journalists in sub-Sahara. Following the recent visit to Tunisia by Barbara Leaf, the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near Eastern Affairs, the State Department says the U.S. is committed to supporting the North African country in laying the foundation for political stability and economic growth. Leaf's visit underscored the U.S.-Tunisia partnership is strongest when there is a shared commitment to democracy and human rights. Meanwhile, Tunisian political parties said the government of President Kais Saied is unable and unqualified to face the country's challenges. VOA senior analyst Mohamed Shenawi discussed these developments with Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I think what we've seen is that Saied was really not happy about the statement that came out following Barbara Leaf's visit. And if you look at the readout from the Tunisian side, it's very different from that of the U.S. side. Saied said he rejected U.S. interference in Tunisia's affairs, he affirmed Tunisian sovereignty, and he pushed back against a variety of U.S. statements that have been critical of his actions. So what we can see is that clearly Saied is paying attention to what U.S. officials have to say. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that he is being swayed by U.S. pressure. I think these engagements are really important for Saied to realize that the international community is paying attention to what he does, but we shouldn't expect them to have a major impact on his behavior or change the path that he's taking the country on right now.
Meanwhile, the Tunisian opposition accused President Kais Saied of pledging the country's sovereignty to the IMF and attempting to involve Tunisia in regional conflicts in reference to his recent reception of the leader of the Polisario Front, Ibrahim Ghali, which caused a diplomatic crisis with Morocco. What's your take on that?
So I think on the IMF deal, this is really nothing new. You know, for the entirety of Tunisia's transition, we have seen major societal cleavages over the proposed IMF reforms, with some parties on the left and the unions rejecting the reforms and other parties accepting them and encouraging them. So Saïd is in a really difficult position because he needs the IMF deal, both for the support it would provide, but also to help unlock additional international financing. But he also needs the support of the union and the public as pushback against him and his actions has been growing, and he really is hemorrhaging support. So the crisis with Morocco is not coming at a very good time for him. You know, he's been cozying up to Algeria, and Algeria has been one of the most vocal supporters of Saïd's actions and one of the only countries to actually give some support to Tunisia during this last year. So it's not really surprising that Tunisia could end up in hot water with Morocco over its growing closeness to Algeria. But this particular crisis and allowing Ghali to have a seat at this conference and to play the role of sort of a leader of an independent state has upset not only Morocco, but also many Tunisians, and is just an unnecessary complication for Saïd at what is already a very difficult time for him.
Political parties in Tunisia warned on Monday that the country is facing imminent collapse and chaos, and in a joint statement, they said that the government of President Kais Saïd is unable and unqualified to face challenges, and according to the parties, Saïd alone is responsible for the consequences of imminent collapse and chaos in light of his inability to lead a salvation mission. What could that lead to in Tunisia?
I think this is one more signal that Saïd no longer represents the will of the people, as he claims. Now, he has had sole control over the country for a year, and he's failed to implement any sort of policies or reforms to assist Tunisia in addressing its economic and social crises. So what we could see coming out of this is further clashes, whether that's protests, sit-ins, other forms of nonviolent resistance against Saïd by the public, who is growing increasingly wary of what he is doing and increasingly impatient at his inability to deliver. But the real question, I think, is how does he respond to these public displays of satisfaction? Does he allow peaceful protests, or does he push back violently, as he has done sometimes in the past, leading to further chaos? And I think Tunisia is really at this critical point right now. We're not sure which direction the country is going to go.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Shenawi. Somalia's president, Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud, has fired and replaced the mayor of the capital, Mogadishu, Omar Felish. Analysts say the president was dissatisfied with security in the capital, where Islamist militants killed 21 people at a hotel last month. Mohamed Daisani reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
In a decree issued Wednesday, President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud appointed Yusuf Hussein Jimale as Mogadishu's new mayor. In the decree, Mahmoud said that he took the action on the recommendation of the Interior Ministry. He said the new mayor, who also becomes the governor of the Banadir Regional Administration, has the experience to fulfill his new responsibilities. Yusuf Hussein Jimale, better known as Madale, will replace Omar Mahmoud Mohamed Felish, who had been mayor since August 2019. Felish was criticized for lack of development projects during his term. The city has also seen continued attacks from militant group Al-Shabaab, most recently in August, when fighters stormed a popular hotel, killing 21 people and wounding more than 100 others. The Somali president did not say why he was firing Felish, but political analysts say the new president wanted to install a mayor who can follow his development and security policies. Jim Ale was also mayor of Mogadishu from 2015 and 2017, when Mahmoud served his first term as president. Mohamed Daisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Nabil Biyajer in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com or look for us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. On behalf of producer Nadia Taha and engineer Nashwan Ghali, thank you for tuning in and for choosing The Voice of America.